I was very angry, but I met neither anger nor apology in him. Will you tell me why? After a while, he said, yes, and then paused again. During the pause, I began to think that an inept and undefended alien should not demand reasons from the Prime Minister of a kingdom, above all when he does not, and perhaps never will, understand the foundations of power and the workings of government in that kingdom. No doubt this was all a matter of Shifkrathor, prestige, face, place, the pride relationship, the untranslatable and all-important principle of social authority in Karhide and all civilizations of Gethin. And if it was, I would not understand it. Did you hear what the king said to me at the ceremony today? No. Estravan leaned forward across the hearth, lifted the beer jug out of the hot ashes, and refilled my tankard. He said nothing more, so I amplified, "The king didn't speak to you in my hearing." "Nor in mine," said he. I saw at last that I was missing another signal. Damning his effeminate deviousness, I said, "Are you trying to tell me, Lord Estravan, that you're out of favor with the king?" I think he was angry then, but he said nothing that showed it. Only, "I'm not trying to tell you anything, Mr. I." "My God, I wish you would." He looked at me curiously. "Well, then, put it this way. There are some persons in court who are, in your phrase, in favor with the king, but who do not favor your presence or your mission here. And so you're hurrying to join them, selling me out to save your skin," I thought. But there's no point in saying it. Estravan was a courtier, a politician, and I a fool to have trusted him. Even in a bisexual society, the politician is very often something less than an integral man. His inviting me to dinner showed that he thought I would accept his betrayal as easily as he committed it. Clearly, face-saving was more important than honesty. So I brought myself to say, "I'm sorry that your kindness to me has made trouble for you." Coals of fire. I enjoyed a flitting sense of moral superiority, but not for long. He was too incalculable. He sat back so that the firelight lay ruddy on his knees, and his fine, strong, small hands, and the silver tankard he held, but left his face in shadow. A dark face, always shadowed by the thick, low-growing hair and heavy brows and lashes, and by a somber blandness of expression. Can one read a cat's face, a seal's, an otter's? Some Gethinians, I thought, are like such animals, with deep, bright eyes that do not change expression when you speak. "I've made trouble for myself," he answered, "by an act that had nothing to do with you, Mr. I. You know that Karhide and Orgrin have a dispute concerning a stretch of our border in the high North Fall, near Sassanoth. Argovan's grandfather claimed the Sinith Valley for Karhide, and the Commensals have never recognized the claim. A lot of snow out of one cloud, and it grows thicker. I've been helping some Karhidish farmers who live in the valley to move back east across the old border, thinking the argument might settle itself if the valley were simply left to the Orgata, who have lived there for several thousand years. I was in the administration of the North Fall some years ago and got to know some of those farmers. I dislike the thought of their being killed in forays or sent to voluntary farms in Orgrin. Why not obviate the subject of dispute? But that's not a patriotic idea. In fact, it's a cowardly one, and impugns the Shifkrathor of the king himself." His ironies and these ins and outs of a border dispute with Orgrin were of no interest to me. I returned to the matter that lay between us. Trust him or not, I might still get some use out of him. "I'm sorry," I said, "but it seems a pity that this question of a few farmers may be allowed to spoil the chances of my mission with the king. There's more at stake than a few miles of national boundary." "Yes, much more. But perhaps the Ecumen, which is 100 light-years from border to border, will be patient with us a while." "The Stabiles of the Ecumens are very patient men, sir. They'll wait 100 years or 500 for Karhide and the rest of Gethin to deliberate and consider whether or not to join the rest of mankind. I speak merely out of personal hope and personal disappointment. I own that I thought that with your support..." I, too. Well, the glaciers didn't freeze overnight. Cliché came ready to his lips, but his mind was elsewhere. He brooded. I imagined him moving me around with the other pawns in his power game. You came to my country, he said at last, at a strange time. Things are changing. We are taking a new turning. No, not so much that, as following too far on the way we've been going. I thought that your presence, your mission, might prevent our going wrong, give us a new option entirely. But at the right moment, in the right place. It is all exceedingly chancy, Mr. I. Impatient with his generalities, I said, You imply that this isn't the right moment. Would you advise me to cancel my audience? My gaffe was even worse in Karhidish, but Estevan did not smile or wince. I'm afraid only the king has that privilege, he said mildly. Oh, God, yes, I didn't mean that. I put my head in my hands a moment. Brought up in the wide-open, freewheeling society of Earth, I would never master the protocol or the impassivity so valued by Karhiders. I know what a king was. Earth's own history is full of them. But I had no experiential feel for privilege, no tact. I picked up my tankard and drank a hot and violent draught. Well, I'll say less to the king than I intended to say when I could count on you. Good. Why good? I demanded. Well, Mr. I, you're not insane. I'm not insane. But then neither of us is a king, you see. I suppose that you intended to tell Argovan, rationally, that your mission here is to attempt to bring about an alliance between Gethin and the Ecumen. And rationally, he knows that already, because, as you know, I told him. I urged your case with him, tried to interest him in you. It was ill done, ill-timed. I forgot, being too interested myself, that he's a king, and does not see things rationally, but as a king. All I've told him means to him simply that his power is threatened. His kingdom is a dust mote in space. His kingship is a joke to men who rule 100 worlds. But the Ecumen doesn't rule, it coordinates. Its power is precisely the power of its member states and worlds. In alliance with the Ecumen, Karhide will become infinitely less threatened and more important than it's ever been. Estevan did not answer for a while. He sat gazing at the fire, whose flames winked, reflected from his tankard and from the broad, bright silver chain of office over his shoulders. The old house was silent around us. There had been a servant to attend our meal, but Karhiders, having no institutions of slavery or personal bondage, hire services, not people, and the servants had all gone off to their own homes by now. Such a man as Estevan must have guards about him somewhere, for assassination is a lively institution in Karhide, but I had seen no guard, heard none. We were alone. I was alone with a stranger inside the walls of a dark palace, in a strange, snow-changed city, in the heart of the ice age of an alien world. Everything I had said, tonight and ever since I came to Winter, suddenly appeared to me as both stupid and incredible. How could I expect this man or any other to believe my tales about other worlds, other races, a vague, benevolent government somewhere off in outer space? It was all nonsense. I had appeared in Karhide in a queer kind of ship, and I differed physically from Gethinians in some respects. That wanted explaining. But my own explanations were preposterous. I did not, in that moment, believe them myself. I believe you, said the stranger, the alien alone with me. And so strong had my access of self-alienation been that I looked up at him bewildered. I'm afraid that Argovan also believes you, but he does not trust you, in part because he no longer trusts me. I have made mistakes, been careless. I cannot ask for your trust any longer, either, having put you in jeopardy. I forgot what a king is, forgot that the king in his own eyes is Karhide, forgot what patriotism is, and that he is, of necessity, the perfect patriot. Let me ask you this, Mr. I. Do you know by your own experience what patriotism is? No, I said, shaken by the force of that intense personality suddenly turning itself wholly upon me. I don't think I do. If by patriotism you don't mean the love of one's homeland, for that I do know. No, I don't mean love when I say patriotism. I mean fear, the fear of the other, and its expressions are political, not poetical. Hate, rivalry, aggression. It grows in us, that fear. It grows in us year by year. We followed our road too far. And you, who come from a world that outgrew nations centuries ago, who hardly know what I'm talking about, who show us the new road... He broke off. After a while he went on, in control again, cool and polite. It's because of fear that I refuse to urge your cause with the king now. But not fear for myself, Mr. I. I'm not acting patriotically. There are, after all, other nations on Gethin. I had no idea what he was driving at, but was sure that he did not mean what he seemed to mean. Of all the dark, obstructive, enigmatic souls I had met in this bleak city, his was the darkest. I would not play his labyrinthine game. I made no reply. After a while, he went on rather cautiously, If I've understood you, your ecumen is devoted essentially to the general interest of mankind. Now, for instance, the Argota have experience in subordinating local interests to a general interest, while Carhide has almost none. And the commensals of Orgeron are mostly sane men, if unintelligent, while the king of Carhide is not only insane, but rather stupid. It was clear that Estravan had no loyalties at all. I said in faint disgust, It must be difficult to serve him if that's the case. I'm not sure I've ever served the king, said the king's prime minister, or ever intended to. I'm not anyone's servant. A man must cast his own shadow. The gongs in Remney Tower were striking sixth hour, midnight, and I took them as my excuse to go. As I was putting on my coat in the hallway, he said, I've lost my chance for the present, for I suppose you'll be leaving Erinrong. Why did he suppose so? But I trust a day will come when I can ask you questions again. There's so much I want to know. About your mind speech, in particular. You'd scarcely begun to try to explain it to me. His curiosity seemed perfectly genuine. He had the effrontery of the powerful. His promises to help me had seemed genuine, too. I said yes, of course, whenever he liked, and that was the evening's end. He showed me out through the garden, where snow lay thin in the light of Gethin's big, dull, rufous moon. I shivered as we went out, for it was well below freezing, and he said with polite surprise, You're cold? To him, of course, it was a mild spring night. I was tired and downcast. I said, I've been cold ever since I came to this world. What do you call it, this world, in your language? Gethin. You gave it no name of your own? Yes, the first investigators did. They called it Winter. We had stopped in the gateway of the walled garden. Outside, the palace grounds and roofs loomed in a dark, snowy jumble, lit here and there at various heights by the faint gold slits of windows. Standing under the narrow arch, I glanced up, wondering if that keystone, too, was mortared with bone and blood. Estravan took leave of me and turned away. He was never fulsome in his greetings and farewells. I went off through the silent courts and alleys of the palace, my boots crunching on the thin, moonlit snow, and homeward through the deep streets of the city. I was cold, unconfident, obsessed by perfidy, and solitude and fear. Chapter 2, The Place Inside the Blizzard. From a sound tape collection of North Carhidish hearth tales in the archives of the College of Historians in Erinrong, narrator unknown, recorded during the reign of Argovan VIII. About 200 years ago, in the hearth of Shoth, in the Pairing Storm Border, there were two brothers who vowed kemmering to each other. In those days, as now, full brothers were permitted to keep kemmer until one of them should bear a child. But after that, they must separate. So it was never permitted them to vow Kemmering for life. Yet this they had done. When a child was conceived, the Lord of Shath commanded them to break their vow and never meet in Kemmer again. On hearing this command, one of the two, the one who bore the child, despaired, and would hear no comfort or counsel, and, procuring poison, committed suicide. Then the people of the hearth rose up against the other brother and drove him out of hearth and domain, laying the shame of the suicide upon him. And since his own lord had exiled him and his story went before him, none would take him in. But after the 3 days' guesting, all sent him from their doors as an outlaw. So from place to place he went, until he saw that there was no kindness left for him in his own land, and his crime would not be forgiven. His transgression of the coal controlling incest became a crime when seen as the cause of his brother's suicide. He had not believed this would be so, being a young man and unhardened. When he saw that it was so indeed, he returned over the land to Shath, and as an exile stood in the doorway of the outer hearth. This he said to his hearth fellows there, "I am without a face among men. I am not seen. I speak and am not heard. I come and am not welcomed. There is no place by the fire for me, nor food on the table for me, nor a bed made for me to lie in. Yet I still have my name. Getherin is my name. That name I lay on this hearth as a curse, and with it my shame. Keep that for me. Now nameless I will go seek my death." Then some of the hearthmen jumped up with shouts and tumult, intending to kill him, for murder is a lighter shadow on a house than suicide. He escaped them and ran northward over the land towards the ice, outrunning all who pursued him. They came back all chapfallen to Shath. But Getherin went on, and after 2 days' journey came to the Pairing Ice. The Pairing Ice is the glacial sheet that covers the northernmost portion of Carhide, and is, in winter when the Guthan Bay is frozen, contiguous with the Gobrin Ice of Orgrin. For 2 days he walked northward on the ice. He had no food with him, nor shelter but his coat. On the ice nothing grows and no beasts run. It was the month of Suzmi, and the first great snows were falling those days and nights. He went alone through the storm. On the second day he knew he was growing weaker. On the second night he must lie down and sleep a while. On the third morning, waking, he saw that his hands were frostbitten, and found that his feet were too, though he could not unfasten his boots to look at them, having no use left of his hands. He began to crawl forward on knees and elbows. He had no reason to do so, as it did not matter whether he died in one place on the ice or another, but he felt that he should go northward. After a long while the snow ceased to fall around him and the wind to blow. The sun shone out. He could not see far ahead as he crawled, for the fur of his hood came forward over his eyes. No longer feeling any cold in his legs and arms, nor on his face, he thought that the frost had benumbed him. Yet he could still move. The snow that lay over the glacier looked strange to him, as if it were a white grass growing up out of the ice. It bent to his touch and straightened again like grass blades. He ceased to crawl and sat up, pushing back his hood so he could see around him. As far as he could see lay fields of the snow grass, white and shining. There were groves of white trees with white leaves growing on them. The sun shone, and it was windless, and everything was white. Getherin took off his gloves and looked at his hands. They were white as the snow. Yet the frostbite was gone out of them, and he could use his fingers and stand upon his feet. He felt no pain, and no cold, and no hunger. He saw away over the ice to the north a white tower like the tower of a domain, and from this place, far away, one came walking towards him. After a while, Getherin could see that the person was naked. His skin was all white, and his hair was all white. He came nearer and near enough to speak. Getherin said, "Who are you?" The white man said, "I am your brother, and Kemmering, Hode." Hode was the name of his brother who had killed himself. And Getherin saw that the white man was his brother in body and feature, but there was no longer any life in his belly, and his voice sounded thin, like the creaking of ice. Getherin asked, "What place is this?" Hodi answered, "This is the place inside the blizzard. We who kill ourselves dwell here. Here you and I shall keep our vow." Getherin was frightened, and he said, "I will not stay here. If you had come away with me from our hearth into the southern lands, we might have stayed together and kept our vow lifelong, no man knowing our transgression. But you broke your vow, throwing it away with your life, and now you cannot say my name." This was true. Hodi moved his white lips, but could not say his brother's name. He came quickly to Getherin, reaching out his arms to hold him, and seized him by the left hand. Getherin broke free and ran from him. He ran to the southward, and running saw rise up before him a white wall of falling snow, and when he entered into it, he fell again on his knees and could not run, but crawled. On the ninth day after he had gone up on the ice, he was found in their domain by people of Orhak Harth, which lies northeast of Shath. They did not know who he was nor where he came from, for they found him crawling in the snow, starving, snow-blind, his face blackened by sun and frost, and at first he could not speak. Yet he took no lasting harm, except in his left hand, which was frozen and must be amputated. Some of the people there said this was Getherin of Shath, of whom they had heard talk. Others said it could not be, for that Getherin had gone up on the ice in the first blizzard of autumn and was certainly dead. He himself denied that his name was Getherin. When he was well, he left Orhak and the storm border and went into the southern lands, calling himself Enoch. When Enoch was an old man dwelling in the plains of Rur, he met a man from his own country and asked him, "How fares Shath domain?" The other told him that Shath fared ill. Nothing prospered there in hearth or tilth, all being blighted with illness, the spring seed frozen in the ground, or the ripe grain rotten, and so it had been for many years. Then Enoch told him, "I am Getherin of Shath," and told him how he had gone up on the ice and what he had met with there. At the end of his tale he said, "Tell them at Shath that I take back my name and my shadow." Not many days after this, Getherin took sick and died. The traveler carried his words back to Shath, and they say that from that time on the domain prospered again, and all went as it should go in field and house and hearth. Chapter 3. The Mad King. I slept late and spent the tail of the morning reading over my own notes on palace etiquette and the observations on Gathinian psychology and manners made by my predecessors, the investigators. I didn't take in what I read, which didn't matter, since I knew it by heart, and was reading merely to shut up the interior voice that kept telling me it has all gone wrong. When it would not be shut up, I argued with it, asserting that I could get on without Estevan, perhaps better than with him. After all, my job here was a one-man job. There was only one first mobile. The first news from the Ecumen on any world is spoken by one voice, one man present in the flesh, present and alone. He may be killed, as Pelege was on Four Taurus, or locked up with madmen, as were the first three mobiles on Gao, one after the other. Yet the practice is kept, because it works. One voice speaking truth is a greater force than fleets and armies, given time. Plenty of time. But time is the thing that the Ecumen has plenty of. "You don't," said the interior voice. But I reasoned it into silence, and arrived at the palace for my audience with the king at second hour, full of calm and resolution. It was all knocked right out of me in the anteroom before I ever saw the king. Palace guards and attendants had showed me to the anteroom, through the long halls and corridors of the king's house. An aide asked me to wait, and left me alone in the high windowless room. There I stood, all decked out for a visit with royalty. I had sold my fourth ruby, the investigators having reported that Githenians value the carbon jewels much as Terrans do, I came to Winter with a pocketful of gems to pay my way, and spent a third of the proceeds on clothes for the parade yesterday and the audience today. Everything new, very heavy, and well-made as clothing is in Carhide. A white knit fur shirt, gray breeches, the long tabard-like overtunic, hieb, of blue-green leather, new cap, new gloves tucked at the proper angle under the loose belt of hieb, new boots. The assurance of being well-dressed augmented my feeling of calm and resolution. I looked calmly and resolutely about me. Like all the king's house, this room was high, red, old, bare, with a musty chill on the air as if the drafts blew in not from other rooms, but from other centuries. A fire roared in the fireplace, but did no good. Fires in Carhide are to warm the spirit, not the flesh. The mechanical industrial age of invention in Carhide is at least 3,000 years old, and during these 30 centuries, they have developed excellent and economical central heating devices using steam electricity and other principles, but they do not install them in their houses. Perhaps if they did, they would lose their physiological weatherproofing, like Arctic birds kept in warm tents, who being released get frostbitten feet. I, however, a tropical bird, was cold. Cold one way outdoors and cold another way indoors. Ceaselessly and more or less thoroughly cold. I walked up and down to warm myself. There was little besides myself and the fire in the long anteroom, a stool and a table on which stood a bowl of fingerstones and an ancient radio of carved wood inlaid with silver and bone, a noble piece of workmanship. It was playing at a whisper, and I turned it a touch louder, hearing the palace bulletin replace the droning chant or lay that was being broadcast. Carhiders do not read much, as a rule, and prefer their news and literature heard, not seen. Books and televising devices are less common than radios, and newspapers don't exist. I had missed the morning bulletin on my set at home, and half-listened now, my mind elsewhere, until the repetition of the name several times caught my ear at last and stopped my pacing. What was it about Estravan? A proclamation was being reread. Therum harf rem ir Estravan, Lord of Ester in Kerm, by this order forfeits title of the kingdom and seat in the assemblies of the kingdom, and is commanded to quit the kingdom and all domains of Carhide. If he be not gone out of the kingdom and all domains in 3 days' time, or if in his life he return into the kingdom, he shall be put to death by any man without further judgment. No countryman of Carhide shall suffer Harth Remir Estravan to speak to him, or stay within his house, or on his lands, on pain of imprisonment. Nor shall any countryman of Carhide give or lend Harth Remir Estravan money or goods, nor repay any debt owing him, on pain of imprisonment and fine. Let all countrymen of Carhide know and say that the crime for which Harth Remir Estravan is exiled is the crime of treason. He, having urged privily and openly in assembly and palace, under pretense of loyal service to the king, that the nation dominion of Carhide cast away its sovereignty and surrender up its power in order to become an inferior and subject nation, in a certain union of peoples, concerning which let all men know and say that no such union does exist, being a device and baseless fiction of certain conspiring traitors who seek to weaken the authority of Carhide in the king, to the profit of the real and present enemies of the land. Adgurney, Tuwa, 8th hour in the palace in Irinrang, Argavan, Harge. The order was printed and posted on several gates and road posts about the city, and the above is verbatim from one such copy. My first impulse was simple. I cut off the radio as if to stop it from giving evidence against me, and scuttled to the door. There, of course, I stopped. I went back to the table by the fireplace and stood. I was no longer calm or resolute. I wanted to open my case, get out the ansible, and send an advice urgent through to Hein. I suppressed this impulse also, as it was even sillier than the first. Fortunately, I had no time for more impulses. The double door at the far end of the anteroom was opened, and the aide stood aside for me to pass, announcing me, Genry I. My name is Genly, but Carhiders can't say L, and left me in the Red Hall with King Argovan 15. An immense, high, long room, that Red Hall of the King's House. Half a mile down to the fireplaces, half a mile up to the raftered ceiling, hung with red, dusty drapes or banners, all ragged with the years. The windows are only slits or slots in the thick walls, the lights few, high and dim. My new boots go eck, 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 as I walk down the hall towards the king, a 6 months' journey. Argovan was standing in front of the central and largest fireplace of three, on a low, large dais or platform. A short figure in the reddish gloom, rather pot-bellied, very erect, dark and featureless in silhouette, except for the glint of the big seal ring on his thumb. I stopped at the edge of the dais and, as I had been instructed, did and said nothing. "Come up, Mr. I. Sit down." I obeyed, taking the right-hand chair by the central hearth. In all this, I had been drilled. Argovan did not sit down. He stood 10 feet from me with the roaring, bright flames behind him, and presently said, "Tell me what you have to tell me, Mr. I. You bear a message, they say." The face that turned towards me, reddened and cratered by firelight and shadow, was as flat and cruel as the moon, winter's dull, rufous moon. Argovan was less kingly, less manly, than he looked at a distance among his courtiers. His voice was thin, and he held his fierce lunatic head at an angle of bizarre arrogance. "My lord, what I have to say is gone out of my head. I only just now learned of Lord Estrivan's disgrace." Argovan smiled at that, a stretched, staring grin. He laughed shrilly, like an angry woman pretending to be amused. "Damn him," he said, "the proud, posturing, perjuring traitor. You dined with him last night, eh? And he told you what a powerful fellow he is, and how he runs the king, and how easy you will find me to deal with since he's been talking to me about you, eh? Is that what he told you, Mr. I?" I hesitated. "I'll tell you what he's been saying to me about you, if you've an interest in knowing. He's been advising me to refuse your audience, keep you hanging about, waiting, maybe pack you off to Orgrin or the islands. All this half-month he's been telling me, damn his insolence. It's he that got packed off to Orgrin." Again the shrill, false laugh, and he clapped his hands together as he laughed. A silent, immediate guard appeared between curtains at the end of the dais. Argovan snarled at him, and he vanished. Still laughing and still snarling, Argovan came up close and stared straight at me. The dark irises of his eyes glowed slightly orange. I was a good deal more afraid of him than I had expected to be. I could see no course to follow among these incoherencies but that of candor. I said, "I can only ask you, sir, whether I am considered to be implicated in Estrivan's crime." "You? No." He stared even more closely at me. "I don't know what the devil you are, Mr. I, a sexual freak or an artificial monster or a visitor from the domains of the void, but you're not a traitor. You've merely been the tool of one. I don't punish tools. They do harm only in the hands of a bad workman. Let me give you some advice." Argovan said this with curious emphasis and satisfaction, and even then it occurred to me that nobody else in 2 years had ever given me advice. They answered questions, but they never openly gave advice, not even Estrivan at his most helpful. It must have to do with Shifkathor. "Let no one else use you, Mr. I," the king was saying. "Keep clear of factions, tell your own lies, do your own deeds, and trust no one. Do you know that? Trust no one." "Damn that lying, cold-blooded traitor. I trusted him. I put the silver chain around his damn neck. I wish I'd hanged him with it. I never trusted him. Never." "Don't trust anybody. Let him starve in the cesspits of Mishnori, hunting garbage. Let his bowels rot. Never." King Argovan shook, choked, caught his breath with a retching sound, and turned his back on me. He kicked at the logs of the great fire till sparks whirled up thick in his face and fell on his hair and his black tunic, and he caught at them with open hands. Not turning around, he spoke in a shrill, painful voice. "Say what you've got to say, Mr. I." "May I ask you a question, sir?" "Yes." He swayed from foot to foot as he stood facing the fire. I had to address his back. "Do you believe that I am what I say I am?" "Estevan had the physicians send me endless tapes about you, and more from the engineers at the workshops who have your vehicle and so on. They can't all be liars. And they all say you're not human." "What then?" "Then, sir, there are others like me. That is, I'm a representative of this union, this authority." "Yes, very well. What did they send you here for? Is that what you want me to ask?" Though Argovan might be neither sane nor shrewd, he had had long practice in the evasions and challenges and rhetorical subtleties used in conversation by those whose main aim in life was the achievement and maintenance of the Shifgrathor relationship on a high level. Whole areas of that relationship were still blank to me, but I knew something about the competitive, prestige-seeking aspect of it, and about the perpetual conversational duel which can result from it. That I was not dueling with Argovan, but trying to communicate with him, was itself an incommunicable fact. "I've made no secret of it, sir. The Ecumen wants an alliance with the nations of Gethin." "What for?" "Material profit, increase of knowledge, the augmentation of the complexity and intensity of the field of intelligent life, the enrichment of harmony and the greater glory of God, curiosity, adventure, delight." I was not speaking the tongue spoken by those who rule men, the kings, conquerors, dictators, generals. In that language there was no answer to his question. Sullen and unheeding, Argovan stared at the fire, shifting from foot to foot. "How big is this kingdom out in nowhere, this Ecumen?" "There are 83 habitable planets in the ecumenical scope, and on them about 3,000 nations or anthrotypic groups." 3,000, I see. "Now tell me why we, one against 3,000, should have anything to do with all these nations of monsters living out in the void." He turned around now to look at me, for he was still dueling, posing a rhetorical question, almost a joke. But the joke did not go deep. He was, as Estevan had warned me, uneasy, alarmed. 3,000 nations on 83 worlds, sir. But the nearest to Gethin is 17 years' journey, in ships that go at near light speed. If you thought that Gethin might be involved in forays and harassments from such neighbors, consider the distance at which they live. Forays are worth no one's trouble across space. I did not speak of war for a good reason. There's no word for it in Karhaidish. Trade, however, is worthwhile, in ideas and techniques communicated by Ansible, in goods and artifacts sent by manned or unmanned ships. Ambassadors, scholars, and merchants, some of them might come here. Some of yours might go off-world. The Ecumen is not a kingdom, but a coordinator, a clearinghouse for trade and knowledge. Without it, communication between the worlds of men would be haphazard, and trade very risky, as you can see. Men's lives are too short to cope with the time jumps between worlds. If there's no network and centrality, no control, no continuity to work through, therefore they become members of the Ecumen. We are all men, you know, sir, all of us. All the worlds of men were settled eons ago from one world, Hein. We vary, but we're all sons of the same hearth. None of this caught the king's curiosity or gave him any reassurance. I went on a bit, trying to suggest that his Shifgrathor, or Karhides, would be enhanced, not threatened, by the presence of the Ecumen. But it was no good. Argovan stood there sullen as an old she-otter in a cage, swinging back and forth from foot to foot. Back and forth, baring his teeth in a grin of pain. I stopped talking. "Are they all black as you?" "Gethinians are yellow-brown or red-brown generally, but I had seen a good many as dark as myself." "Some are blacker," I said. "We come all colors." And I opened the case, politely examined by the guards of the palace at four stages of my approach to the Red Hall, that held my ansible and some pictures. The pictures, films, photos, paintings, actives, and some cubes, were a little gallery of men, people of Hine, Shifwar, and the Cetians of Es and Terra and Altera, of the Uttermosts, Capitan, Olul, Four Taurus, Rockanen, Ensbo, Seem, Gedi, and Shachel Haven. The king glanced at a couple without interest. What's this? A person from Seem, a female. I had to use the word that Gathinians would apply only to a person in the culminant phase of Kemmer, the alternative being their word for the female animal. Permanently? Yes. He dropped the cube and stood swinging from foot to foot, staring at me, or a little past me, the firelight shifting on his face. They're all like that? Like you? This was the hurdle I could not lower for them. They must, in the end, learn to take it in their stride. Yes, Gathenian sexual physiology, so far as we yet know, is unique among human beings. So, all of them out on these other planets are in permanent Kemmer. A society of perverts. So Lord Tibby put it. I thought he was joking. Well, it may be the fact, but it's a disgusting idea, Mr. I. And I don't see why human beings here on Earth should want or tolerate any dealings with creatures so monstrously different. But then perhaps you're here to tell me I have no choice in the matter.